and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. George Weissman, a physicist who's been around a long time studying consciousness. And I first found out about him from Elizabeth Rauscher in a new book called How the Hippies Save Physics, written by Dave Kaiser. And so I called him up and talked, and I'm now sitting in awe of this, what this man has done and what he's trying to do for the world, and I wanted you all to meet him. So welcome, Dr. Weissman. Thanks for taking the time to come on my show.
Hi, Eva. Thank you very much for the introduction.
So before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, what you do now, and how you came to do it?
Well, currently I'm writing a book about the quantum paradigm, which is the worldview associated with quantum physics. And I am doing some experimentation in the area of telekinesis, or a special form of psychokinesis, which is relevant to the quantum paradigm.
So what, so that my listeners will understand, what do you mean when you say telekinesis?
Well, telekinesis, or more generally, psychokinesis, is basically mind over matter. It's the influence of intention over a physical process of some kind. And telekinesis in particular is a special form of psychokinesis, is the movement of matter through intention, moving an object with your mind only.
And What is that telling us about the model that conventional science has in comparison to the model that quantum theory has?
Well, more specifically, classical science, the science that was universally valid until around 1900, and was then gradually supplanted by relativity and quantum theory, took. This classical physics is based on a worldview which we call the classical paradigm, according to which there is space and time, and there's matter and energy, fields in that exist in that space and time, and that evolve according to the laws of physics. So, according to that view, the phenomena that are known as psychokinesis or telekinesis are supposedly impossible, which is why a lot of scientists who still live in this classical paradigm don't believe that it's possible. And in fact, they even refuse to look at, in many cases, they refuse to look at or are not interested in looking at the evidence, the compelling evidence that shows that the psychokinesis occurs.
So before we get into all this, tell us a bit about your educational background. Why should, you know, the bottom line is, why should people listen to what you have to say? You've studied it very deeply. You've got a PhD, I think, and if you could just tell us a little bit about that so they know who they're listening to.
Yes. I mean, I have a PhD in theoretical physics, specifically in high energy physics, high energy particle physics, which is the study of subatomic particles. Did my PhD at UC Berkeley, then I did a postdoc in Switzerland. I have since turned my interest to more towards what you might call the foundations of quantum theory and the philosophical implications and the experiential implications of quantum theory, which I call the quantum paradigm. It's a worldview that encompasses quantum theory and gives it an interpretation and a meaning.
So I'm curious, how did you move from such a very rigid field of science into even thinking about these things?
Well, when you say, I mean, when I studied quantum theory, it was quite a revolution for me, because before that, I myself was very convinced. I was militant even in my belief in the classical world, in the classical worldview. I did not believe that consciousness had any existence apart from brain processes and so on. I believed that when we were dead, that was the end. I believed that, everything could be explained through deterministic laws and all the usual beliefs. I was very convinced of that. But when I studied quantum theory, especially when I studied it in Berkeley under the guidance of two very leading people, Jeffrey Chu and Henry Stapp, gradually realized that the world as described here was, that this was pointing at a different, completely different world order. And then at some point when I was around 30, I had a mystical experience that showed me kind of directly that the world was not this kind of mechanistic thing that I had believed in before. And quantum theory gradually provided a basis for integrating the world of consciousness, of spirituality, and so on, with the world of science and measurable events. And those two things came together in the course of the last 30 years.
Do you want to share any of your mystical experience, and don't feel pressured to do so? I'm just asking you.
I don't think that you can do justice to a mystical experience by describing it, but you know, it was kind of an experience of all that is, and of the world as alive and as one mind, and you know, those the kinds of things that one hears a lot when one talks about mystical experiences. But the main thing is to experience it and to realize that it, by direct insight, by direct knowledge, something about the nature of the world, which then takes many years and probably many centuries to adequately put into words and into a framework, and probably ultimately cannot really be put into words at all.
So tell us, you did something back in the 70s. You started a group that's really amazing, and that's really the foundation, I believe, of where we are today in consciousness and quantum theory, called the Fundamental Physics Group. And I know I'd never heard of it before, and I read a lot, and I've interviewed a lot of people that were in there, and I'd love for you to tell my listening audience about that group, what it did, who was in it, you know, what you talked about, how it got started.
This was in 1974, and I was doing my PhD at UC Berkeley, and I found that the real questions and the really interesting things were not being addressed. We found ourselves, not just I, but other physics students at the time, found ourselves kind of forced into a very kind of specialized and technical study that did not address the reason that I had started physics, that I was even interested in physics, was to know something more about reality, in simple words. And that I did not find really. I found it was useful in what I learned. The techniques and the theories were useful, ultimately, in understanding it, but the activity I was engaged in at the time as a research physicist did not satisfy me. And what happened was that Elizabeth Rauscher and I started talking about it. She was at the Lawrence Radiation Lab at the same time. We started talking about how unsatisfactory things were, and that we could maybe form a discussion group of physicists and other scientists who were interested in a broader approach, including consciousness and psi phenomena and the meaning of quantum theory and UFOs and whatever else there was out there. And so the talk turned into action, and we formed this group, and we started meeting. And within a few months, it was like there were 50 people, and it was really becoming a hub of... because, you see, there had been many people who felt the same way, but we were all isolated. But when we got into this group and we started, we all had somewhat different interests, but they all meshed. And so when we got into this group, there was a kind of synergy that really gave rise to a new kind of, to a whole new direction. And that was very, very exciting. It lasted 3 years until I'd finished my PhD, and both Elizabeth and I moved away from the Bay Area at the time, and then the group collapsed as suddenly as it had been formed. But in those 3 years, or 4 years, nearly 4 years, it did an amazing amount of work and discovery and changed, opened up physics in the sense that it was now beginning to be okay and popular to look at, for instance, at physics and mysticism, to look at the implications of quantum theory for worldview, to look at psychic phenomena, to look at consciousness. These things all have since become much more fashionable. But at that time, they were really we were part of what created that.
Who were some of the people involved in that? So I think it's people that people are reading and studying today that they didn't realize started so young.
Well, there were some people were steady people who were working at the lab, and other people were, you know, coming in when they were in town. There was Henry Stapp and Jeffrey Chu, two physicists who were and especially Henry Stapp was a regular and played an important role. There was Fritjof Capra, who became known for his book, you know, for his initial book, The Tao of Physics, and from there he went on to other books. There was Gary Zukav, who was not a physicist, but who was very attentive and worked together with us in putting together the Dancing Wu Li Masters, which was also a great hit. There was Nick Herbert with Quantum Reality. There were some of the people who had... were not so known, but they actually deserve to be very known because they did the first experiments in what is today known as entanglement, quantum non-locality, the thing that one a cause here can have an effect over there without anything traveling in between. And there was David Bohm whenever he came through town, and David Finkelstein. The SRI people, you know, the people at Stanford Research Institute, Puthoff and Targ, who did the first remote viewing experiments, and on and on. I don't have a list here, but
Fred Allen Wolf and Jack Sparty, those are two people that people are looking really.
I'm sorry, who else?
Fred Allen Wolf and Jack.
Yes, of course, and Jack. I'm sorry, and Jack Sarfati. Who both made you know, kind of quite a name since then. In fact, a lot of us went on and kind of had an influence in how our culture developed.
It's been amazing, and new people started it. Thank you. Okay, let's get into your questions. So the first question, and I think you and I talked about this today, is please tell us specifically what are telekinesis and psychokinesis.
Okay, so psychokinesis is mind over matter. It's the influencing the behavior of matter of physical systems with your mind, with your intention. Be it healing, you know, or the effect on a physical organism, like healing at a distance. Be it I'm talking about psi now. Psi is the study of phenomena that cannot be explained through conventional physics because they are non-local. And psi and telekinesis in particular is the movement of objects at a distance. You know, like ESP is the picking up of thoughts or impressions at a distance. There's a whole family of phenomena. And within that, telekinesis is how you can influence matter, how you can change the course of events just with intention.
Okay. And how, let's see, can the average person do this? The average person walking around on the street, if you just walked off the street and plucked someone out, can they do this?
Well, most people are not aware that they can do that, of course. But it has been determined through very careful scientific research that even the average person without any training or even very much encouragement can have a very small effect on, let's say, for instance, so-called random processes, you know, like if you throw a coin and it's either heads or tails, but you can do that electronically and through a quantum phenomena. It's basically a signal that has a one or a zero. Such random series are generated in large numbers and recorded, and then you have you find, for instance, that a device has 50-50 exactly probability of heads or tails, and then you have a person trying to influence him to get more heads or more tails, and it was found that most people had a very small but nevertheless non-zero influence on that. But if people were particularly trained, like, for instance, meditators, practitioners of yoga, martial artists, then the degree of effect already was considerably larger than that, but still small. So that kind of psychokinesis, that kind of PK, that kind of influence on physical phenomena is called micro-PK, because the influences are on an atomic scale. You influence an atom, for instance, to decay to the left or to the right, and depending on that, there's a different Geiger counter register them, and one turns on a red light and the other turns on a green light. So when you're watching this, you see a red light or a green light randomly turning on and off, back and forth, and you tell the person, try to get more red than green, and they will find, you know, for instance, people like martial artists and so on would have maybe a 2% deviation. Instead of 50-50, on the average, they might get 51-49 or something like that. So that's the kind of thing that was really well researched and that provided the evidence for psychokinesis.
So this is something that you do yourself on a regular basis. How often are you successful?
Well, I myself do something more difficult now. I actually move a macroscopic object. I suspend, let's say, I take a paper spiral or a plastic wheel or an aluminum foil pinwheel or some kind of object like that. I suspend it either by a string or on a needle, and then I mount it within a enclosed, sealed environment, usually made of glass, so that the thing is completely impervious to outside influences, or as impervious as possible. I mean, you can blow, you can shake, you can do various things, and it doesn't move. And so that I use, then with my intention, I make the wheel or whatever object it is spin, turn one way or the other. You can leave this object for hours or days. You can film it continuously. You see it doesn't move at all. Then, you know, when I determine that I'm doing it, I don't move. I just sit there. Nothing is moving. And then when I intend one way or another, then nearly immediately, and sometimes within 10 or 15 seconds, but usually immediately, the object responds and starts rotating. And I can do that now. At the beginning, it was kind of on and off, but now I can do it repeatedly. I mean, practically every time.
So This is that in conflict with classical physics?
Yes, it is true. That is in conflict with classical physics, but it is not in conflict with quantum physics.
So why do you think that classical physicists have such a resistance to doing this? To even taking a look at it.
Well, at this point, every physicist studies quantum theory and knows how to use it, but their worldview, you see, quantum theory doesn't give you a picture of the world. Quantum theory only tells you, if you do this experiment, then you'll find this result with the following probability. So it tells you what you find in an experiment, but it doesn't actually describe, for instance, if you're studying an electron, it doesn't describe what the electron is. And any model that you make of, for instance, of an electron or an atom is deficient. It turns out in one way or another, it doesn't explain the full data. So matter has become, within quantum theory, not modelable, but only modelable in terms of behavior, of measurement results, but not in terms of what it is. And so because there is no model, there has been no model of what a quantum system is, therefore, because we always want to work with models, physicists who actually know very well that such a model is not compatible with the observed results, nevertheless, still think in terms of classical models. This is an unconscious process, but when they do that, then it becomes impossible to conceptualize how, for instance, an influence can travel from... Let me give you an example. I sit in front of my computer looking at an object which is far away all through Skype. You know, it could be in a different city. I've done it even in a different country. So the object is thousands, maybe thousands of miles away from where you are. And then when I focus on the object, and this is more difficult than doing it within direct sight because it's more indirect. I mean, you don't really have the same relationship to the object easily that you have when you're facing it. And that's why it's more difficult. But when I do that, and when I'm kind of, let's say, when my energy is strong, I can actually move this object at thousands of miles just as easily as if it's in the next room. The distance doesn't seem to play a role. And there is no way in classical physics that could happen, because something would have to travel from my mind, from my brain, according to classical physics, is producing the thoughts, so that from that physical process, which is the brain currents or chemical reactions, would have to be able to influence an object thousands of miles away, and that is considered impossible. According to classical physics, that's considered impossible. And that's why most scientists don't pay attention to this, don't take it seriously, don't know the evidence, don't study the evidence, and it's kind of like remained its own field where people who are open to it and who are interested in it know about it, but the mainstream is just barely aware of it, of the research.
What does this mean for the world, George? What does this mean for how we can change our lives and how we... Our world is failing. It's falling apart. It's decaying. Our lives, everything about it, our medical system, everything. So what good does this do for us to show us that we can actually do something about our world?
Well, the answer to that is somewhat... You know, has to be built up. The first thing that one can say is that the quantum paradigm, which is the, as I repeat, is the is the kind of philosophy or the paradigm that builds the that forms the foundation of quantum theory, that contains quantum theory, and in which we interpret, within which we interpret quantum theory as a remodeled quantum theory. So the quantum paradigm has some really amazing features. First of all, the world, you could say the world, the arena of the world is mind, with a let's say with a capital M, because it's not the individual mind of when we say mind, we usually mean the human, like my mind, your mind, and so on, the dog's mind. But this is, if you will, the cosmic mind, or it's kind of, it's mind at large. So the arena where everything plays is mind. And the forms of the mind, which means the forms of experience, or the experiences, or the distinctions that we make, all those things are they populate this world. So the world is mind populated by experience and whereas the normal, the classical paradigm, the world exists in space and time and is made of matter. So these two things don't even seem compatible. And you could ask, how could a model that's based on mind, kind of think of it like a dream. In a dream, if you have a lucid dream and you're aware that you're dreaming, you realize that the tree that you're dreaming there is not quote really there, or doesn't have an objective existence. It exists in your mind together with yourself as part of the experience. So it's a little bit like that. So, but then we have to explain why the physical world that we experience and which seems so solid and law-like to us can coexist in this kind of, call it a dream space or mind space. How can the world be that? And with quantum theory, you can kind of show how classical behavior, classical-like behavior, occurs on average with large systems. So the world as a material system, although it doesn't exist, is simulated by quantum behavior at large scales. I mean, if you have a tennis ball, it turns out that these forms behave kind of like the perception of a tennis ball would.
I have a question here, and this is something that you and I have talked hours about, I mean literally hours, over the past couple of months. So I'm going to ask it to you, and you know that we have trouble with language on this. I do, so I do the best I can. But it's the way that if one of my listeners could ask you this question, this is the how they would word it, okay, because we're not physicists. So you're going to probably laugh. And by the way, I want to tell you something. You know how we were talking about Elizabeth Rauscher today?
Yes.
While we were sitting here, my cell phone's been ringing, and I looked at it, and it was Elizabeth Rauscher.
<That's
good. laughs> Is that a synchronicity or what? Anyway, everybody, when I try to talk to them about this, that just when I give lectures, you know, to people who are just finding out about this kind of stuff, they say, what do you mean reality is virtual? I can touch this chair and I can touch this table and I have this horrible life with all this misery happening in it. You know, it is, I have this person being mean to me or my, you know, whatever is going on. So if the first question is, does matter exist on the quantum level?
Well,
is this world really what we think it is, the way the average person thinks that it is, or is it something else?
No, that's what I was saying. The average person in our culture today thinks of the world as a classical in classical terms. In other words, there are chairs, there are objects, they're made of atoms. Those atoms evolve, you know, on the large scale. We have stars and galaxies and so on. That's the model that we have and that we believe in. We actually believe that it's true, not just that it's a good model, but that it's true. Now, a physicist nowadays doesn't think so much that, doesn't look for a true theory, because I think that's not even a goal anymore. The goal is to make a good map that we can understand what we observe and predict what other things will happen and so on. And if it works very well in that way, we call it a valid theory. But it's not the way things really are. In other words, the reality presumably is indescribable, is beyond, reality is beyond description. But the approximations we make in order to describe a physical world are explained by quantum theory. And you can see how matter doesn't ultimately exist, and yet things behave in a matter-like way at a certain scale. So the simple answer to your question is no. According to this paradigm, matter does not exist in and of itself independently. The observer, the subject, and the apparent object, in other words, I who am observing the chair and the chair that's being observed, that totality has to be considered. You cannot just take the chair and forget the subject and think that you have a meaningful description of reality.
Okay, so that being the case, if matter really doesn't exist on the quantum level, that means that we can change our realities, right?
Well,
and I'm doing this very simplistically because I know you've said that already, but I want people to really get it. That we can change our lives, we can change our world, we can change everything around us. But people say, oh, that's impossible because, you know, I wish all the time, I think I want a new Cadillac in my front yard and it doesn't appear. So what is it that people have to do to change their realities? Does that make any sense?
Well, yes, but I mean, if you take even a simple thing like moving an object, like the practice that I'm doing, even a very simple thing like that actually took years. It took, first of all, I had to study it somewhere, and I can tell you where I studied it and so on, and what I studied, but I had to study it, and then when I came home, it was still kind of touch and go and sporadic, and I didn't really have any much control over it. So then it took me years of practice on a daily basis to get to a point where I can repeatedly move an object. So that is also true. And the way you do it is not the way you think you do it. It's not like willing the object to do this or that, to move. But it's more a kind of gentle interplay, an intermingling of me and the object, a kind of becoming one or something like that.
Can you give me a better description of that? Because I know people are going to want to look into this and try to do this. So what do you mean when you say that?
When I say what?
When you say it's not willing it, then what is it? When you sit down and do it, George, what do you do?
I could. There's various things that I can do, but one of them is just I sit, I contemplate the object, I kind of form the subject-object unity between it. I also bring up
my energy.
Remember,
you're lay people here, so tell us what you mean you form a unity with subject-object.
Well, that is not something I can say quickly. I mean, I had to study that for quite a while. It's a meditative practice. I'm not saying that this is the only way that you can do telekinesis, but my telekinesis teacher told me that there are actually two ways you can, in a simplified way, there are two ways that you can do it. One is kind of by willing, by forcing, but the other one is much more wholesome and also much more powerful, and that's by this what I call, the oneness of subject and object, and then you just move that object like you would move your own arm. You just move it. You learn the kinesthetic feeling of what it feels like to move the object, and you just do it. I can't give you instructions over the phone, but it is something that can be learned by everyone.
I know you're working on some videos. Are you going to put something on YouTube or something?
I already have hundreds of clips on my iPhone, but tomorrow I'm having my son kind of videotape it professionally. He does that, and then I will put it online, because and I especially through this radio show, I wanted that to be, you know, to be able to show that to people.
That would be great. So another question I've always wanted to ask is something that is in Dave Kaiser's book, because I want to understand this, and I'm sure my listeners probably do. What is Bell's theorem, and what is the importance of that? This is catching you a little off guard, but I've been looking at this book.
Einstein was the first person in the mid-30s, that means that 10 years after the discovery of modern quantum theory, he pointed out that this was really weird, because you could kind of create two particles out of the decay. You let a particle decay into two, and you move them. They move into opposite directions, and let's say one is 100 miles east and the other one is 100 miles west, and you do measurements on them, and then the way that one person measures their particle has seemingly an immediate effect on what the other person will find. So there's like an immediate effect of A on B without anything being able to travel from A to B. So Bell's theorem then showed that there can be no underlying theory, no local theory I'm trying to see how you could simply explain it. A local theory is a theory in which things can only have an effect within their immediate vicinity. So, for instance, I turn the switch and the light goes on. The light goes on maybe 100 feet from where the switch is, and if something is local, then you have to be able to trace cause and effect from the switch to the light in a kind of continuous way. And the way we do that, of course, if we know about electricity, is that there is an electric current that flows through the wire all the way to the light, and that explains that. Or if you have a radio-controlled plane, you know, then you turn your switch and the plane hundreds of feet in the air responds to it. What is that? Well, as we now know, there are electromagnetic waves that travel from my control device to the plane, and they carry the effect. So that, in physics, always you have this kind of what is called local effect. There has to be something that travels from A to B to produce the effect that you are causing. And in quantum theory, this was discovered that this was not necessarily the case, that there was a correlation between A and B, which couldn't be explained because nothing was going from A to B, because they were actually simultaneous, let's say. So there couldn't be anything, because things can only travel with the speed of light, so there couldn't be anything. Anyway, Bell showed that those kinds of effects that you observe, the quantum effects, cannot be produced by any local theory. So reality is essentially non-local.
So my question now is, how do you keep up with, as small as an electron is, how do you keep up with it and know that that's the one that you're measuring?
Well, that's the one of the things you discover is electrons have no identity. They have no existence as things in the first place,
uh-huh.
and if they did have an existence, then it would be really weird that they wouldn't have an identity, because you could kind of, you would think that you could follow it along its orbit and from A to B, and you'd know that that is, this is the, by following it, you'd know that it's the same electron. But in quantum theory, in the very formalism of quantum theory, things don't have an identity. Particles don't have an identity. And so, and in fact, as it turns out, they don't have an existence as particles, an objective existence as particles. They are more like messages or signals that carry information from A to B, but they don't carry that information through space.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, I had always wondered when people talk about measuring it. And what difference does it make whether the spin is measured as up or down?
What do you mean, what difference does it make?
Well, I was just reading this sentence here. Wigner wondered, the consciousness of a human observer were the only thing that could break the regress and register a definite response spin measured as up or down. What is the significance of whether it spins up or down, or is there any?
I mean, there's a kind of measurement that you can perform where if the spin is up, then the particle will move up by moving through a magnetic field. Or if the spin is down, then it'll move down. So it's just two ways that it can behave.
So it has nothing to do... When I think about consciousness creating reality, one of the things I think of sometimes is imagine consciousness being an ocean. And when particles pop up, it forms something, and they sink back down. And I guess when you observe it, they pop up and form what you're observing, and then they go back down, and it goes back into, I guess, the non-dual state. So I wonder how things actually form physical reality. Can you help me understand
Remember, in the quantum paradigm, what you call physical reality are... like the actual things are observations or distinctions that you make. Like, for instance, going up or down, that is a distinction that you can make. There are events. These are events, if you will, mental events. We make a distinction. It goes up or down. And those are the real things. I mean, those are the things within this paradigm. Those are the things that are real. In other words, the events of our experience, whether we observe the particle, what we call the particle, up or down. That is the observation itself, the knowledge, the information, is the real thing. All the so-called material things that we, according to the classical paradigm, we have all these material things that exist, particles and chairs and tables and planets. All those are abstractions. They're actually abstractions that allow us to form expectations as to what we're going to find. For instance, if we have if we think of something as a tennis ball, then we'll expect it to roll and fall and behave a certain way. And if that expectation is right, that those are the experiences we have, then we believe in the model, then we believe that there is a tennis ball. But that's all the concept of a tennis ball or any kind of object serves is to explain our experience. The experience is the real thing.
Okay. One question that I always ask everybody is, because there's such a linguistic problem in science, is when you talk about the word consciousness, what is your definition of that thing, and do you use that word in more than one way? Like, some people use it as the ground of all being. Some people use it as awareness.
Exactly.
You use it both ways. And how do you differentiate when you're talking to someone that you're talking about something different?
It's difficult. Like in Sanskrit, which is a very precise language of experience, and in particular of meditative experience, you have very very sophisticated distinctions between all different kinds of mind and consciousness and awareness and this and that, and because people are all practitioners and they've all experienced these states and they know what we're talking about, communication becomes possible. in the West, where there's been mostly focus on the so-called external world, on the purported world of objects and fields and so on, consciousness has not been very prominent, at least studied, until very recently. And so we're really kind of still in an infant stage, and we don't even have a common language. Everybody uses it the way they want. But when I talk about consciousness, I mean either the ground of all being, awareness, you know, presence, being, kind of interchangeably, or I talk about individual consciousness, which is a very structured kind of conditioned form of awareness. And
so,
through the context, you recognize which one is talking about.
So one question that I always think about, and I don't think it's one you and I have ever even talked about, is how does Big Mind segregate itself into all of our little minds? How does that, do you have any idea how that happens?
Yeah, that's kind of one of the central
mysteries. And our question, yeah.
Yeah. It's not a question that a physicist can easily answer. I mean, that belongs in my domain as a physicist, but I don't think that it actually segregates itself. I think there's a loss of awareness. You could think of the set of conditionings that we call brain. You can think of that as a filter that filters out a tiny spectrum of all that is, which happens that spectrum, which is important to our survival as biological organisms, and forms a kind of a model world and a model self for that purpose. So it's like a filter in which the infinite richness of Big Mind is kind of brought down to manageable and useful information that is useful for us to survive. I mean, that's kind of a mechanistic explanation a little bit, but I think it kind of serves to show how this form of consciousness that we animals have evolved, because it allows us to take in sensory perceptions and then respond accordingly, so to guide our movements, you know, towards procreation, food, escape from enemies, and so on. So it formed in that context, that limited consciousness. In plants that don't have the possibility to move, that kind of consciousness was not even useful, and so presumably another form of consciousness formed. I mean, These forms always, they kind of serve an evolutionary purpose.
Do you believe, what is your opinion on free will? And as we've talked about this is a trick question, is do you believe we have complete, and that's the word, that's the trick word, complete. Do you believe we have complete free will?
Well, you know, we are very highly conditioned beings. Both Buddhism and recognizes that, but also modern psychology and biology recognize that. I mean, first of all, we have the whole infrastructure that we call our brain and our nervous system, and
hello, George, Don. I think he disappeared on me.
Let's me say this: we're so conditioned.
Cut out. Long time. I think we missed.
I'm sorry?
You disappeared for probably 30
seconds. Oh, I'm sorry. We're so conditioned as beings that the moments where kind of where we would have even the opportunity of free will, are relatively rare. So we can go through most of our lives kind of so conditioned, so habitual, so kind of conditioned by our organism, by our culture, by this and that, that you can say we barely exercise free will. But we do, I believe, have the opportunity, and the higher developed our consciousness is, the freer it is.
I agree with that. Not that it matters, but I do. So we've got about 10 minutes. You can talk about anything about telekinesis or psychokinesis that we've not covered, or you can talk about alternative medicine or your opinion on whatever you want to talk about. Have you got anything you want to cover that we've not covered?
Oh, I mean, yeah, we've covered only a small part of what one could cover, but, you know, we had an hour, and I'd like to maybe say a little bit more about how I learned telekinesis. So once I'd become aware that telekinesis was important because quantum theory interpreted through the quantum paradigm predicts the phenomenon of telekinesis, whereas all other possible interpretations of quantum theory, and there are some other interpretations, do not allow for telekinesis, and in fact reject the possibility that it could be there. So this was an important way to distinguish, to find out if this particular interpretation that I developed, and with others together, I mean, it's of course not only my thing, it's a whole informal team, whether that quantum paradigm is empirically verifiable. In other words, what science would demand, that you don't just have a theory, that you actually can do an experiment and show that this is so. And so telekinesis is like a criterion. If it exists, it seems to indicate that the quantum paradigm is at least on the right track. If it doesn't exist, then the quantum paradigm would be wrong, and one of the other possible interpretations are correct. So that I became very interested in telekinesis, and because there were indications from research, from a lot of research, that this phenomenon existed, but it seemed as if it would really be it's very unlikely that it's just something that Uri Geller has or some special person has. You would expect some people to be better than others, but you would expect everybody to have it. And indeed, those experiments I was talking about, those random number generator experiments, show that everybody does, to a very small degree, have it. But I thought maybe you can develop it, and then you can actually demonstrate it. You don't have to. This is such a seemingly miraculous phenomenon that when people are told about research, they say, "Oh well, you know, maybe." Maybe there's some hole in some gap in the methodology. Maybe it's cheating. Maybe it's this or maybe it's that. That's how scientists get away with not facing the phenomenon. So I wanted to do something that I could just do and show people, and show myself above all. And so when I heard about 3 years ago that this was being taught at the Biosensory Institute for Biosensory Psychology in Russia, in Leningrad or St. Petersburg, as it's now called, I decided to go. They told me that they would guarantee me that I could learn it. I thought that was very unlikely because I somehow didn't think that I could ever learn something like that. I had tried for years to do this on my own and had completely failed. The thing that I now do every day repeatedly, I had tried for years and I had completely failed to produce an effect. So anyway, I went there, I spent 2 weeks there, and in those 2 weeks, after 4 days, I was actually able to start turning objects. And what did I study? Mostly, I studied just how you can perceive and manipulate what is called subtle energy, the energies that go through your meridian systems or through your chakras, you know, the system, the energies that the occult traditions and spiritual traditions have talked about and which are an integral part of those traditions. But here we actually learned how to feel those energies and direct them. So after 4 days, I was able to, I walked to a room where the equipment was set up, without even any teacher or anybody even knowing that I was doing that,
and I was able to move it. And that was just the beginning. And once you know how to do it, then you can actually learn from experience, because you see what works and what doesn't work. It's like a feedback mechanism, and you can get stronger and stronger. But before that, when I didn't know what to do at all, I couldn't ever produce a significant enough effect to even learn from it. So there's a kind of sharp cutoff that you have to get beyond that point until you can start learning from experience. And then you have to be very persistent and interested and motivated, which I was. But those things are just specific characteristics that I have and that prompted me to do what I did. But anybody can learn it. And we actually invited the telekinesis teacher, Natalia Shareko, Dr. Natalia Shareko from Russia, to give a couple of workshops here at IONS and other places. And we had a total of 200 students, and the course lasted a weekend, and everybody was able to learn it, every single person who stayed. There were some people who left for one or the other reason, but everybody who stayed, and that was most of us, 200 people, was able to learn how to do that, at least at that time, in that room, with that inspiration and so on. Now, when you get home, it's another story. But as my own example shows, once you have that seed of experience, you can proceed from there to learn it. So this is a gift that everybody has, and it's part of an even bigger gift, this is just moving objects, but you can actually influence events. You can shape events. I mean, you can shape our life, and collectively, we can shape our collective life in ways which are not tracked by just the material influences, by moving your muscles, by saying things, by moving certain things. There's something about intention that if it's held correctly in the right way, then it can have enormous influence in the world. And I believe we are moving to get back to the question of what is the significance of this. I believe that we have the potential to wield this power. We need a lot of wisdom to wield this power, otherwise it can also be abused, but we can actually create a better world. And just by understanding that we are all one, which is what the quantum paradigm says, we are all manifestations of one mind, when it is embodied, when it becomes part of our experience and not just an abstract intellectual knowledge, but actually embodied in our experience, then we begin to act for the common good instead of just our own self, because our sense of self now encompasses all creatures. And I think that the lives of people like the Buddha and Jesus and so on, who have embodied that kind of awareness, shows that when you actually do that, then you also act ethically. But it can be abused by people who just learn incompletely. And I have a little bit of trepidation about helping to put this in the world. But I just feel that if we don't make that step towards a cosmic kind of like the step that of the shifting to the quantum paradigm, shifting to an awareness of the nature of the world as mind, if we don't do that, then I think our enormous power that technology gives us dooms us, because at our present level of ethical maturity, experience shows that we cannot wield those powers. The technology is already running away from us and is being abused by a small minority to gain even more control over the majority. So we're kind of headed towards the abyss in many different ways, ecological, social, economic, you name it. And I think this transformation that is necessary for us to become a sustainable and benign form of life is involved with the shift that I call the quantum paradigm.
You know, that's very interesting. You're bringing up that concern, because I have a friend who is an Orthodox rabbi, and we were talking about Well, when I first got my experience where I, you know, suddenly had these psychic abilities, this medical intuition thing, I didn't know where it came from, and so I went to talk to him about it, and he said, you know, Eva, this was actually in the Talmud thousands of years ago, but the rabbis decided to remove it because people were using it to hurt other people and over money and material things. So you're absolutely right. I mean, there is the potential that it will be used wrongly, so it's got to be used ethically and with integrity. So, the end of our show. So, do you know when you expect your book out?
Probably towards the end of 2013. And the website, which I'm only building right now, you won't find anything there yet, but probably in about a month you'll find the telekinesis clips and maybe a small interview. Maybe this interview. The website is called www.quantumparadigm.org.
Well, I can promise, as long as you're willing, you'll be back here.
Thank you.
And I hope that I'm free to tell my listeners that we're trying to put together some lecture topics together so that we can do that and help teach people. I hope that's okay for me to say, but we're trying, and hopefully we'll be successful, and so maybe you'll see us out there together one day.
Yes. Very nice, Eva.
So thank you, Dr. Weissman, for coming on my show. Thank you for having the nerve and the chutzpah to get out there and do this back in the 70s and get it started, because it's really turned out to be the foundation of all that's going on today, and so I thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
And we'll talk soon.